So the bulk of the Gemara is concerned with matters of halacha. What are you allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do? And we would say approximately 65% of the Gemara deals with halachic matters, but up to 35%, and I don't know the exact number of words or pages, deals with something that is called either agada or hagada, depending if you're a Cockney or not. Again, the Aramaic form is agada or agadata, and that's the same as hagada, which literally means narration. And the question is, what is the meaning of agadata? What makes something hagada versus halacha? And in many ways, that's not an easy definition. In some ways, the only definition we have for hagada or agada is anything in the Talmud that is not dealing with halacha, meaning it's a definition of exclusion as opposed to an affirmative content. And the reason is the realm of Agadah is very, very, very broad. It encompasses many, many things. It encompasses interpretation of biblical stories, the story of Moshe, the story of Yosef, the stories of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. It encompasses Talmudic biography, let's say the story of Rabbi Akiva's life, and, you know, later figures in the Talmud. It encompasses ethics. It encompasses morality. It encompasses philosophy of life, the goals to which, you know, your life should be directed. It also contains Chazal's reflection on business, astrology, astronomy, medicine, science. Now, these do not necessarily have a common denominator. The only common denominator is they are not halakha. So it's very interesting. If you look in the Rishonim, for the classical definition of Agadah, that's exactly what they say. Agadah is anything in the Talmud that is not a matter of obligation, of do's or don'ts. But it's been well said, and I believe this was said by Rav Kook himself, although not in the Sefer we'll be looking at, that halakha is defined as the body, the guf of Judaism. Just as the body physically carries out functions, halakha tells me physically what I am supposed to do and what I'm not supposed to do, right? It deals with the realm of the translation of the Torah into physical action and inaction. The Agadah is the neshama of what it means to be a Jew. Halacha will tell me what I can do and what I cannot do on Shabbat. Agadah will tell me what is the spiritual meaning of Shabbat. And the truth of the matter is, a Jew has to be both. Sometimes people who are less committed to Shmirat HaMitzvot, they naturally love the Agadah. Because the Agadah talks about spiritual values, etc., it doesn't automatically say you gotta change your life. Conversely, sometimes halachic Jews, the Orthodox Jews, might be so committed, as it were, or rightfully committed, to the do's and don'ts of the halacha, that they don't have a spiritual vision. It's just kind of a superficial observance that they go through. What the Navi Yeshayahu called mitzvat anashim milumada. People do things out of habituation, but they don't see the neshama. They don't see the purpose. They don't see the goal. And Chazal themselves speak very highly about their own Agadah, Agadah generally. They say, Ritzoncha shetakir mi sha'amar v'hayaha olam. If it is your desire to know and recognize God who spoke and brought the world into being, lamod Agadah, learn the Agadah. And in a way, Agadah in the yeshiva world, for example, has been a very, very neglected stepchild. You know, in the Gemara, when we're learning halacha, and we spend a lot of time on halacha, and then we reach Agadah. And by the way, those of you who do Daf Yomi or No Gemara, you can almost always tell from the Tzurat Hadaf, just the shape of a page of Talmud, when you're going to hit Agadah. Agadah tends to have much less commentary on the page. So as a result, the page is big. So whenever you see a big page of Gemara with very little Rashi or Tosfos, you almost know for sure that it's Agadah. The rows are wider also. That's right. Now, for some people, that's a great relief. Oh, Baruch Hashem, we finally have a break. And indeed, some commentaries have suggested that Agadah was put in to give people breaks between the extreme concentration of the Talmud. By the way, another difference is Agadah tends to be in a purer Aramaic. You know, rabbinic Aramaic is often a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic. Agadah is hard to translate because Haggadah is almost pure Aramaic, but really it was the opposite. For us, it might be harder to translate, but since Haggadah was geared to the common man in some ways, it was in a vernacular that even the common man would be able to understand. It was really the opposite. Just like Shnayim Mikra V'Yechad Targum, it's such a funny thing. Why did Chazal institute the mitzvah that you're supposed to read the Parsha with the Uncles? Because Aramaic was the spoken language during the Second Temple period, more so than Hebrew. More so than Hebrew. And therefore, Chazal wanted you to read the Torah in a form that every single person could understand. Now, today, it's exactly the opposite. If I read the Uncles, I don't know what Uncles means. I got to look in the Chumash. I look in the Hebrew. Maybe I'll figure out what the Uncles is. It's almost as if, instead of the Targum helping us for the Mikra, it's the Mikra that helps us for the Targum or the like. But what happens in the yeshiva world, if you notice, anyone that's been in a yeshiva shir, we're learning halakha, halakha, halakha. We get Agarata, the Rebbe skips it. We're going to skip the next three pages. So, now, in many, many ways, therefore, Haggadah was considered to be superficial for the common man, the balabayas, etc. But in point of fact, Chazal, and of course everyone who came after Chazal, saw in the Haggadah, the neshama of Torah, and also the deepest philosophical and theological ideas expressed through metaphor and symbol and the like. And in fact, Rav Chaim Shulevitz, the great Rosh Hashiva of Mir, once said, the reason we skip Haggadah is not because it's so hard, so easy rather, we skip it because it's so hard. We literally don't always have the ability to penetrate to its inner depths. Now, this is why, in a sense, Haggadah has a double character. On one hand, on a superficial level, it is easier and attractive, and it's Moshech the Lev, because everybody can understand the story. But on its deeper level, it's extremely profound and esoteric. So at the same time, it is both the most accessible part of the Torah, and it's the least accessible part of the Torah. Haggadah is very much connected to Sisrei Torah, the mysteries of the Torah. Haggadah slides into Kabbalah, and the like, and it's all connected. Now, just to give you a story from the Gemara in Sota about Haggadah and Halakha, already in the time of the Mishnah, the Tanoim, there were some rabbis who specialized in Halakha and some rabbis who specialized in Haggadah. In fact, even Rabbi Akiva was once given a little bit of a tochecha. Rabbi Akiva, who was known as the greatest of the halachic scholars, he ventured into Haggadah, and one of the rabbis told him, Akiva, you should stick to Negoyim and Olo, stick to the complicated halachic topics, leave the Haggadah to other people. So the Gemara tells us two stories. Two Amoraim came to town. One darshaned in a complicated halachic topic and got a very small audience. And the other darshaned with the parables of the Haggadah and he had a huge audience. The Baal Halacha, who was a great Talmud Chacham, felt very bad. He felt very sad. So the Baal Haggadah wanted to comfort him. And of course, he comforted him by a parable, because that's what the Baal Haggadah does. And he says, two merchants came to town. One was selling cheap pots and pans, and the other was selling the most precious diamonds that nobody could afford. So the one who was selling the diamonds didn't get a big audience. How many people are going to be able to buy diamonds? The one who's selling the cheap pots and pans, everybody goes, because everybody can buy pots and pans. So the rabbi of the Haggadah said, with great humility, of course, that I am a merchant of pots and pans, so everybody comes to me. You are selling the most precious diamonds. Not that many people can afford it. Now, a little word of definition. What is the difference between Haggadah, Haggadah to Haggadah, they're all the same, versus Medrash? There is Medrash, and there is Haggadah. And what is the difference in the terms? We often say there is a Medrash that says, or we say there's an Haggadah that says. What exactly is the difference? So I just want to point out, just for definitions, and definitions are helpful, that there are really three different distinctions between Medrash and Haggadah. Distinction number one, which is the least important, but I'll mention it, is that often when people refer to Medrash, they are not referring to Haggadah in general, but they are referring to specific works that contain Haggadot. And Haggadot can be found in the Talmud, but there are works that are called Medrash. There's Medrash Rabbah, Medrash Tanchuma. So you have to be careful. When a person says, the Medrash says, does he mean the works that are called Medrash, or does he just mean the rabbis interpreted, which might be in the Gemara? Now, the truth of the matter is, there actually is an overlap. There are many Midrashim that are both in the Medrash and in the Gemara itself, in the Talmud itself, but each one has material not in the other. So, difference number one is that sometimes Medrash refers to a particular literary work, meaning even if the content is the same, but you know, there's Medrash and there's Gemara. That's the least important, but once again, one has to know what is your source. Distinction number two, the word Midrash actually means to investigate, and it refers to interpreting biblical verses. It refers to interpreting the Lashon of a Pasuk in the Torah, the Nevi'im, and Kesuvim. Now, Agada, much Agada, maybe the majority of Agada, is indeed Medrash, because Agada is often based on interpretation of biblical verses, sometimes in a very far-fetched way, and I'll get to that. But there is Agada that you might call free-floating. So, for example, when we have an Agadata that talks about the story of Hillel, you know, freezing on top of a roof, that's not a midrash because it is not connected to the interpretation of psukim. So we could say the following. In order to be called medrash, literally, medrash is linked to biblical interpretation. Agada may be medrash, but agada doesn't have to be medrash because agada is not always linked to biblical interpretation. Now, that brings me to a third distinction. Since Medrash means biblical interpretation, it is not always Agada. For example, in the works that we call Medrash, we have what are called Midrashei Halacha and Midrashei Agada. So if the Gemara has a drasha, for example, whether an eye for an eye, ayin tachas ayin, is meant to be literal, which we say it's not, or it refers to compensation, and the Gemara goes through a methodological process, that is a process of Medrash, but it's not Agada, because it is defining halacha. So, for example, svarim like the Sifri, the Mechilta, they are midrashim, but they are halachic midrashim. They are not agadic midrashim. The Medrash Rabbah, the Medrash Tanchuma, Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, are agadic midrashim. So, therefore, we could say the following. Midrash and Agadah overlap considerably. It is true that many, maybe most agadot, are Midrashim. They do overlap, and the terms are often used interchangeably, but they are not exactly the same. Number one, Midrash can sometimes refer to specific books, right? So Agada can, when I say something's an Agada, it could mean it's in the Gemara, it could be the Bavli, the Yerushalmi, the Medrash Rabbah, right? So Agada is a broader term. Medrash might refer to specific books, number one. Number two, Medrash is limited to biblical interpretation, and when you have freestanding teachings or stories, that is Agada, that's not Medrash. And number three, Medrash can mean halacha that is derived from verses. So that's an example of Medrash that's not Agada. So you can have Agada that's not Medrash, you can have Medrash that's not Agada, and you can have, of course, Agada that is Medrash. So it's important to be aware of these differences. Now, in the time of the Rishonim, let's say between the 10th century and the 15th century, we have masterful, great works on halakha that were produced. We have the commentaries, of course, of Rashi and Tosfos and the Ramban and the Rashba and the Ritva, and we have the codifications of the Rif and later the Rambam and then the Tur and eventually the Shulchan Aruch and the like. And basically the foundations of our understanding of halakha and our understanding of the Talmud were laid during these centuries. That is why to this day, the primary learning, when we learn Gemara Be'iyun, you know, in depth in the yeshiva world, we focus on what are called the writings of the Rishonim, the writings of those great medieval authorities who laid the foundations for truly understanding Talmudic analysis. However, what is strange, and for reasons that are not entirely clear to us, during this period of time, there is comparatively little written on the Agadot. that was a neglected area. I mean, the simplest, the most obvious way you can see that is look at the paucity of Rashi's own commentary on the Agadah, right? As they say, the reason the page is bigger and the lines go out more is because Rashi and Tosfos didn't write very much on the Agadot. There are some Agadic interpretations. I don't mean to say that the field is totally bereft, but basically it does not seem to be a major preoccupation, at least in the written record. Perhaps because it was regarded as esoteric, perhaps it was regarded as kind of the realm of Kabbalah, in which there was not great exposition of this. Now let me say though, I will say that the Rashba himself, one of the great Rishonim of Spain, did write a short work on selected Agadotot in Shas. We actually have Chidushei HaRashba al Agada, but it's certainly not a complete comprehensive commentary. He just picks a few episodes. But for some reason, once we get to the time of the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo, in particularly the 16th century, we see an explosion of interest in the world of Agada. And I'll mention some of the works that came out then. And one always has to wonder, why do certain things emerge at certain times? You know, it's interesting. Everything is in the Torah, right? Everything is in the Torah. In effect, there is no such thing. You know, Shlomo HaMelech said in Kohelet, we read it on Sukkot, Ein kol chadash tachas HaShemesh. There is nothing new. And indeed, in Judaism, there can be nothing new. If something is new, then by definition, it's no good. And yet, we find that although nothing is new, everything has to be authentically connected to the Torah and the Mesorah. Certainly, things are new in terms of what is emphasized and what is embraced and what is taught. At different generations, certain ideas come to the fore. You know, the Hasidic movement, again, to take examples far afield, didn't invent anything new. If the Baal Shem Tov talked about the importance of Avat Yisrael and the importance of every single Jew being precious to God, even if they're not learned, that is not a new idea. That is found in Chazal. That is found in the Torah itself. But in different generations, different ideas are emphasized. Sometimes they come to the fore. Some things recede in the background. Things come to the fore. Jewish life is a pendulum. And as I say, genuine innovation is going to be treif. You know, that's the reform movement or whatever it is. But innovation within the framework of certain ideas being emphasized at certain times, that is part and parcel of life. And we have to assume that on some ultimate level, that is directed by Hashgacha Pratit to bring to the forefront the ideas that we as Jews have to integrate at different times in our lives. Another example, let's say, was the Musar movement of Rav Yisrael Salanter. Rav Yisrael Salanter invented a movement in the 19th century emphasizing ethics, morality, and Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. Now, did he create that? Did he invent that? Of course he didn't invent that. Everything is based on the Torah and then Chazal. But for various reasons, certain things had been de-emphasized, people weren't paying attention to it. He brought it back to the forefront. So we have to say the same thing with Agada. Agada was always there, obviously. No new texts were invented. But there was a resurgence in exploring the inner meanings of the Agada. Now, why that's so, as I say, why at a particular time, a particular place, do these ideas emerge? It's hard to know. I'll just mention a few possibilities, or one main possibility. And that is, keep in mind that during this very period of time, this was the, what you might call almost the popularization of Kabbalah itself. This was during the time of the Arizal, Rav Moshe Cordovero, Rav Yosef Karo. Kabbalistic ideas, which had been limited to very small groups of people, began to be spread outwards and taught to large segments, sometimes in a negative way, because in some way the growth of Kabbalah was connected to Shabtai Tzvi later because you had too many unqualified people who were into Kabbalah. But nevertheless, there was a need for people to get involved in this. And at least some historians do connect it to the aftermath of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. We don't realize that now because, unfortunately, we live in a generation that has gone through a Holocaust and the like, you know, things much worse. But at the time, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492 was regarded as a calamity of mammoth, gargantuan proportions, analogous to the Churban Beis Hamikdash, which indeed, of course, it occurred on the 9th of Av in 1492. And people were struggling to understand, why has this tragedy befallen us? And therefore ideas were developed that this is a precursor to Mashiach. It is the wars of Gog and Magog. People were looking at mystical meanings to try to understand the meaning of suffering. And as a result, Kabbalah expanded. Interest in Agadata expanded. And again, this might be connected in that way. Others have even suggested the invention of the printing press had something to do with this, because a lot of Agadic works that had just been in manuscript and not so accessible all of a sudden became available, and people began to read them, people who had not read them before, and they need a commentary. As I say, this would be speculation, but let me just mention three major developments in the 16th and the beginning of the 17th century, which kind of revolutionized the study of Agada. The first comes from the Sephardic world, and this was the creation of the book that is called Ein Yaakov. And let me just mention what the Ein Yaakov is. The author of Ein Yaakov was a man, Rav Yaakov ibn Chaviv, and he was in Turkey and later in Sfat himself. Again, this was in the time, approximately the time of Rav Yosef Karo. And what the Ein Yaakov did, the author of Ein Yaakov, meaning the fountain of Yaakov, is he gathered together, he took out of the Babylonian Talmud all of the Agada, and he published it separately so that people should be able to study the Agada and be able to see the Agada as a unified whole. Which means, now again, he did not do it on the Midrash, he did it on the Agada in the Babylonian Talmud. He started doing it also on the Jerusalem Talmud, but he only did Brachos and Seder Zeroyim and some of Moed. So if you look, if you have an Ein Yaakov and you look, you will notice that for Brachos and Maseches Shabbos, after he has the Babylonian Agada, he has the Yerushalmi Agada as well. For the other Masechtot, he did not, because he died before he was able to finish. So we don't have a complete compendium, although there are later Sfarim that try to do it. Now, obviously, he had to make a decision, what is Agada, what is not, because in the Gemara itself, these are not clearly marked. And you'll find in the Ein Yaakov that sometimes there is a little bit of halacha that's mixed in. It's impossible to totally separate them. Now, the Ein Yaakov itself, there were commentaries written on the Ein Yaakov, etc., if you get, but again, everything in the Ein Yaakov is in the Gemara. But by making it a separate sefer, this enabled the comprehensive study of Agada together with various commentaries. There's an interesting little historical note about Ein Yaakov that I want to share with you. And that is, one of the things that happened in the Middle Ages is that the Catholic Church in Europe was very much involved in the censorship of Jewish books. And in particular, there were actually censorship manuals. In fact, who were their censors? A lot of the censors were apostate Jews. Jews who converted to Christianity, but they knew Hebrew, they knew Aramaic, although many of them were woefully ignorant. And their job was to look at Jewish books and take out anything negative, or anything that might be construed negative, about Christians. So a lot of the stuff about Jesus, which was in the Gemara, was taken out, was censored. But I just want to give you an example of how ignorant the censors were. This is very, very funny. One of the words they were told to take out was, take out the word goy. Because goy, we know when Jews say goy, they always mean insult. So that's why you find that instead of goy, the Gemara often says, oved kochavim, a worshiper of stars. That was not the original text. The original text said goy, but the censors were directed, whenever it says goy, replace it with oved kochavim, because Christians don't worship stars. Okay, so here's an example. In one manuscript, it quotes the pasuk about the Jewish people, that you're a goy kadosh, you are a holy nation. So the censor switched it, oved kochavim kadosh. Right, so it's an example. It was just mechanical. They didn't even know what they were reading. They took out different words and the like. But in particular, the censors did take out any references to Jesus. Now, in later editions of the Talmud, now, some printers wanted to protest this. So you'll actually see in some early shasim, they actually print, and wherever there was a censorship, they have blank lines So a person knows, oh, we took out three lines here. It was a kind of a protest, as it were. But as you know, most Gemaras don't have that. In the more recent Shasim, we've been able to restore some of those censored passages, either through a separate book, or sometimes they actually put it into the daf. Of course, that throws off the Tzures HaDaf a little bit, you know, because the dafim are laid out a certain way. But here's the thing. The censors knew that the Talmud had all this negative information, but the Ein Yaakov was a less familiar book to them. They didn't know what Ein Yaakov was. So what was interesting is that sometimes the Ein Yaakovs that were preserved were a very authoritative source of what the original Girsa was in the Babylonian Talmud. So you could work from the Ein Yaakov to try to reconstruct. Now, what happened was the following. This is an amazing thing. What happened was in the 19th century, you know, the great, great Jewish press for Svarim, that so many definitive editions came out, was the press in Vilna, the defus of the, it goes by the widow and the brothers Ram. Basically, they're the Ram family. Again, the Menachem Mendel Ram had died young, and his business was inherited by his wife and their children. And they ran the greatest printing house in 19th century Europe. The Vilna Shas was the product, the great Vilna Shas was the product of that endeavor, the Shulchan Aruch. Many, all the great, great Svarim came out in wonderful editions. And in fact, I have to say, it was almost a full employment service for poor Talmidei Chachamim, because they were proofreaders, they would write their little notes. Sometimes you'll notice a commentary that just has some anonymous little note at the bottom. No notes, kashas, terutzim. These were like these proofreaders who would write their little ha'aris there. So really, it was a full employment service for pure Talmidei Chachamim and the like. So when they put out their Ein Yaakov, listen to what they said, just to show you how you could reverse cause and effect. They said, we have improved the Ein Yaakov tremendously, because in the course of time, many mistakes are in the Ein Yaakov as evidence from the fact that it diverges from the Talmud. We have therefore corrected the Ein Yaakov to correspond with the correct text in the Babylonian Talmud. Now, problem with that is, it was the Babylonian Talmud that had the wrong text. The Ein Yaakov had the correct text. So, in a sense, they corrected the right text by looking at the wrong text instead of vice versa. It's a reverse, because they thought the Talmud was more authoritative, which it is, but the Talmud was subject to much more censorship. So, the Ein Yaakov became extremely popular, and in fact, in Europe, going back to shtetl life in the 19th century and the 20th century before the war, it was very, very common for the working person who learned Torah every day but could not necessarily follow difficult Gemara, they would go to an Ein Yaakov shir. And there's even a Yiddish expression, which is slightly demeaning, but it shouldn't be. This person is an Ein Yaakov Yid. He's a person who learns Ein Yaakov. Again, halavai that we should be Ein Yaakov Yidden. It's not at all a bad thing to do. But in the elitist yeshiva world of Eastern Europe, which was kind of a very elitist world, the Ein Yaakov Yid was slightly looked down upon in a certain way. So that's development number one. That goes back already to the beginning of Yaakov Ibn Chaviv, the Ein Yaakov. Development number two is truly monumental, and that is, in the 1500s, we have a figure, Yehuda Leva Bar Bezalel, better known, of course, as the Maharal of Prague. The Maharal of Prague was a very, very fascinating person. We know that he was descended from David HaMelech. His yichus is David HaMelech, etc. But the Maharal mi Prague as a person is actually shrouded in mystery. He seems to have come out of nowhere, meaning to say, we don't know who his teachers are. We don't know who his rebbes are. Some have even said he was a self-taught person. All of his godless just came out of his own. So the Maharal didn't seem to have, he must have had some teachers, but he didn't seem to have predecessors. Nor did he have any followers. Again, he certainly had Talmidim who spoke about him with great, great deference. I'll just mention a few that are very famous in their own right. The Tosfos Yom Tov, who was his successor in Prague, speaks about the Maharal as his Rebbe with great, great deference. The Kli Yakor, the great commentary on Drut, on Chumash himself, was a Talmud of the Maharal. But they speak about him with tremendous reverence, but they actually don't follow his derech. His derech is very, very unique. So he's kind of a very unique figure. By the way, I want to point out that although the Maharal's works are almost 100% on Agada, he has many, many volumes, all of which are on Agada, the Maharal was known in his lifetime as a phenomenally great posek in halacha. And somebody once said, somebody once asked Rav Avadya Yosef, and only he would be able to answer this, how many times is the Maharal mentioned by the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch? So Rav Avadya, of course, was able to give an answer right away. I think he said 25 times. And Rav Avadya said, every time the Maharal is mentioned, the halacha is like him. Again, I couldn't give you that answer, but Rav Avadya was able to compute that. You know the story about Rav Avadya. When Bar Ilan put out their CD-ROM of Responsa, so they wanted to show how great it was, so they submitted a shaila to Rav Avadya Yosef, how many Maharal Makomos could he come up with? And then they ran it through their search engine, and they boasted that they got 9 out of the 10 that he came up with. So they said, our search engine is so good that we're 90% of Rav Avadya. That was the mark of their success. But okay, in any event, the Maharal, as they say, was a great, great posek, and the Maharal had a very stormy life as well. The Maharal was Rav of Prague 3 times. Why do I say 3 times? Because he was fired 2 times. meaning to say, the Maharal moved around quite a lot because he was an extraordinarily courageous and outspoken leader. When he saw things in the community, we sometimes think of Gedolim as ivory tower figures. They sit and learn all the time. The Maharal was actively involved in all sorts of social problems. He wanted to change the educational system. He thought, for example, in fact, many of his words are quite modern. He thought, for example, that the emphasis on young students learning a bunch of commentaries instead of concentrating on pshat was very, very destructive. He said that before people go to Gemara, they should follow Pirkei Avos and learn Chumash for 5 years. And then Mishnah for 5 years, and that he would be a proponent of the Zilberman method of chinuch. He was very much against conspicuous consumption. Jews were very poor, but people were spending money on chasanas and bar mitzvahs, and he enacted what are called anti-sumptuary laws, that rich people were not allowed to have more than X number of guests. Really excommunicated people who were involved in Lashon Hara, important people that were spreading rumors. So because of all of this, he sometimes got in trouble with rich and powerful people. And he was fired. He was kicked out of the position. But they always asked him back after a few years, meaning they realized that, you don't get people like Maharal every day. And eventually he did come back. So he had quite a stormy life. And the like. Now, the story of whether he made a golem, people know the story about the golem, in which the golem was like a Superman that protected Jews from blood libels and the like. This is open to the jury. The truth, I'll tell you the problem. The Maharal died in the early 1600s. And the very first time we get a record of the golem is something that surfaces in the 1800s, more than 250 years later, and it's a story about a rabbi who found a long-lost manuscript, etc. Again, this rabbi, unfortunately, although he was a big Talmud Chacham, had a reputation as a forger because there are other documents that he forged. I will not mention his name, etc. So many say that the story of the golem is a legend and it's not true. On the other hand, there are people that say, if you go to Prague, there is a shul, the shul of the Maharal, the Beit Knesset of the Maharal, and in the attic, there was a locked attic that nobody is allowed to go to. And people say that there is this decommissioned golem that's there. But if you open the door, the golem comes to life. And there are different stories about Nazis, Nazis going there. I mean, the reason the shul was not destroyed in World War II is because a Nazi went up there and there was horrendous things that happened, etc. So even the Nazis kept away. Who knows? I believe, too, that the Friedrich Lubavitcher Rebbe, the one before Rabbi Nachum Mendel, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, claims he actually was up there and saw it. I don't know. Who knows? Again, to quote your Rav, to quote Rabbi Wein, he often talks about the stories and he says that if it didn't happen, it could have happened. So who knows? Certainly, I believe the Maharal could have made a golem if he wanted to, but we don't necessarily know that he did. And by the way, the Maharal was held in such admiration, even by the non-Jews in Prague, that there is a big statue of the Maharal in Prague to this day, which was put up by the people shortly after his life. So the Maharal was considered to be extremely, extremely great. And although the Maharal was a great, great posek, he certainly was a great, great posek, but I think we have to say that the Maharal devoted his life, essentially, to the exposition of Agada. And it's been well said that the Maharal really did everything he did based on a very enigmatic passage in the Rambam hundreds of years earlier. And this passage in the Rambam is the following. In the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah, the Rambam briefly discusses Agada, and the Rambam says, Agada is not supposed to be understood superficially, but it is deeply symbolic and communicative of profound spiritual truths. And the Rambam says, I plan to write a sefer explaining the symbolic meaning of the Agadot in Chazal. Unfortunately for Klal Yisrael, the Rambam never wrote such a book. We do not have such a book. And indeed, in the Moreh Nevuchim, where he refers once again to his plan to write such a book, the Rambam indicates, not that he simply didn't have the time, he indicates he deliberately abandoned the endeavor. As he decided not to write the book. And the reason is, he said, that if Chazal wanted to express themselves in symbolism, who am I to open up the key? Who am I to unlock that which they wanted to lock? So there's kind of an ambivalence. It's almost saying, hey, I'm not supposed to explain this stuff. If you get it, you get it. If you don't, it's not for you. Maharal attempts to unlock the symbolic meaning of Agada, and yet he constantly reiterates the Rambam's hesitation. He says, you know, maybe this is not worthy to be revealed, maybe it shouldn't be revealed, but he tries to do it anyway. And here, let me explain this issue. People always ask the question, is Agadata true? Is it true? Is it meant to be taken at face value? Or is some of it bubby mises? Is some of it just stories? So here, let me go back to a few sources on this. Let me mention Ramban for a moment. Ramban lived in the generation after the Rambam in the 1200s and the 13th century. The 13th century, yeah, the 1200s. And the Ramban lived in Catholic Spain. Now you may recall, if you've heard of the disputation at Barcelona, that at the time, instead of television or movies, whatever it is, one of the popular entertainments was going to these public debates. And the Ramban was summoned to debate Judaism versus Christianity by the King of Spain. And the Ramban's opponent was an apostate Jew who had become a Franciscan friar, Pablo Cristiani. And there was a great, great debate, and this guy was bringing in, you know, the things they still do today about Isaiah, you know, Ishayahu, about the virgin birth, and of course the word is not virgin, the word is young woman, whatever it is, different Gemaras trying to show that the Gemara itself acknowledges Yashka as Mashiach. So in the middle of this debate, the Ramban makes a statement that's very far-reaching. The Ramban said that although we believe that Hashem gave the oral law to Moshe Rabbeinu, and when Chazal interpret the Torah, it's binding, when they opine on matters of philosophy, faith, history, theology, these are called midrashim, they represent the isolated opinions of single people, and they are not necessarily binding on the Jewish people as matters of faith. Now that's quite an astounding proposition in which basically the Ramban says, we are not obligated to accept Agada as truth. Most people understand that statement as not representing the Ramban's true position. First of all, the Ramban himself interprets Agada with great deference in all of his commentaries, and they simply understand that because the Ramban was not going to reveal the esoteric inner meanings of things to this guy, because they're only dealing with literal meanings, so he kind of, as the Gemara says, doche oso bakash. He just wants to get rid of him, as it were, without giving a full answer. By the way, the end of the debate was the Ramban was deemed the victor of the debate. That's the good news, Kiddush Hashem. The bad news was, because he was guilty of discrediting the Catholic Church, his punishment was exile. The good news was, that is how the Ramban came to Eretz Yisrael. The Ramban came to Eretz Yisrael because he was expelled from Spain towards the end of his life. That raises a fascinating question, which we don't, you know, this is not our subject today, and that is, given the fact that Ramban maintains that living in Eretz Yisrael is one of the 613 mitzvahs, that's the Ramban's own opinion. How was it that the Ramban himself didn't come to Eretz Yisrael till he was forced out of Spain because of the disposition, because of the debate at Barcelona? So, you know, these are interesting questions. Now, this is Ramban's position. But Maharal has a different approach. Maharal says, this is a false question. Asking whether something is true or false is presupposing that the meaning of truth is literalness. Maharal says, there is no question. Every single statement in Medrash and Agada is true. It is absolutely true. But the meaning of truth does not have to be literal truth. The sages spoke in symbolic, metaphoric language. And therefore, of course it's true, but the truth is not what appears on the surface. You see, people make a mistake. You see, some people say like this, Agada is literally true and I believe it. And if it says Vashti had a tail, I believe Vashti had a tail. They take it literal and they say it's true. Other people take it literal and say it's false. They say, yeah, the sages are saying Vashti had a tail. That's a bunch of garbage. The sages make up crazy stories. The common denominator between these two schools, those who say it's absolutely true and those who say it's absolutely false, is both of them are interpreting the text literally, and they are then drawing different conclusions. Maharal says that is a false dichotomy, because instead of saying it's either literally true or it's literally false, we say it is symbolically true. And the key is to try to understand the symbols and the symbolic meaning that penetrates beneath the surface. Now, you might say, so for example, I'll just give you a quickie example. Vashti has a tail. So the Maharal says, what Chazal actually mean is that when Achashverosh summons Vashti to come naked to the party, she would normally want to do that. She loved to parade her beauty. All of a sudden, she said no. Hashem miraculously made her become a tzanuah, and that is as great a miracle as if she had a tail. Meaning, Chazal are teaching you, Vashti not showing up is the same thing as her growing a tail. It's as strange as that. You might think, oh, it's just Teva, she didn't want to go that day. No, no, no. That's also a miracle. Right? This is a thing like that. So this is a, now you may say, well, gee, is Maharal making this up? I mean, there are rabbis today, by the way, today, that will say, anybody who offers symbolic interpretations of Agada is an apikoros. Unfortunately, they would be calling the Maharal an apikoros, right? There are those that say today, you are obligated to literally believe, every word of Chazal is true. And again, I'm not here to disparage them because I'm just giving you the Maharal. Again, we'll move to Rav Kook, not today, obviously, but we'll move to Rav Kook shortly, at least next week. And that is the Maharal is the great, great champion of symbolic truth. Now, symbolic truth is a wonderful, wonderful way of helping us deal with Agada, although it's a very difficult way. Because on one hand, it shows you the greatness of Chazal, the profundity of Chazal, the depth of Chazal. And on the other hand, it removes the surface problems that we would have where the descriptions of their stories seem to be so far-fetched and implausible that we just don't understand how they would make sense. So it is both defending Chazal from attacks, but it's more than that. It's not only fending off negative attacks, it is also showing the profundity of their wisdom and what we learn out from them. So now you may say, well, did Maharal invent this? He just invented the notion that agadot have symbolic meanings? The answer is, he certainly developed it because he literally gives you almost a passage-by-passage interpretation. But the Ramazim of symbolism go back much earlier. The Rambam himself, in describing the book that he didn't write, talks about symbolic meaning, although he doesn't really explain too many agadas. And even before the Rambam, if we go back to the last of the Gaonim and the greatest of the Gaonim, Rav Haigon, who lived even before the Rambam, Rav Haigon, the Gaonim already had such a tradition that agadot are not meant to be interpreted literally, but it was left to the Maharal, as it were, to give us symbolic meaning. Now, the Maharal is not the end of this interpretive process. We're going to see Rav Kook very much follows, of course, as a modern person who follows the path of the Maharal, but before Rav Kook, the Vilna Gaon, you may know, has somewhat a Kabbalistic commentary on many agadot, in which everything is given symbolic value. In fact, if you are interested, there is a book that was published by Rabbi Aaron Feldman, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael, The Juggler and the King, that actually takes the Vilna Gaon's interpretation on a number of agadot and goes through them. These are the tall tales of Rabbah Bar Bar Chana, which are, again, Rav Kook unfortunately didn't write on that, that's why we're not doing it, which really talk about sea monsters and gigantic creatures and all sorts of very, very strange, we'd call them Paul Bunyan stories in the Talmud. And the Vilna Gaon himself gives all symbolic interpretations of this and the like. Now, so the Maharal's particular books, again, we have four volumes on the Agadot themselves, but every single book of the Maharal, every single book, is essentially an exposition of the symbolic language of the Agada. And that is the great key. All the generations since the Maharal look to the Maharal as the yesod of breaking through. Now, Maharal, of course, had tremendous influence on Hasidus. Maharal is before Hasidus. But, for example, the Balatanya of Shneur Zalman of Liadi is a great-great-grandson of the Maharal. And again, the Maharal's writings, which were neglected for hundreds of years, were always studied by the intellectuals of Hasidim. Now, let me give you an example from Rav Yisrael Salanter of the symbolic language of Agada. He gave an example of a mashal that existed in his time. Now, in the 19th century, Jews were confined in Russia to certain designated areas. They could not live in major cities. This was called the Pale of Settlement. Right? Jews could only live in certain areas. And at the whim of the czars, they were constantly changing the perimeters. They would say, Jews have to leave, you know, you have to leave this district in a week or whatever it is. So this created tremendous hardship. This was, they were going from place to place, wandering around. This is besides the cantonists and other devastating, devastating things, which were even worse. That's when the kids were drafted at eight and they stayed there for 30 years. But one of the other harassments was the constant moving around in the Pale of Settlement. Now, let's imagine you were a journalist at the time. And this is Rabbi Saul Salanter's mashal. And you had a certain yellow journalistic flair. So you wrote the following. A drop of ink drowned 100,000 people. Now, what does that mean? The czar signing a proclamation destroyed the life of 100,000 people. Somebody finds that newspaper 100 years later. They pick up a newspaper that says, a drop of ink from a quill drowned 100,000 people. They would say, what Bubba Mice is here? A quill? A drop of ink from a quill? How big was the quill? Was there some super giant that had a quill? Or were these people like, midgets or whatever, or tiny little people? And you would say, ridiculous story, fairy tale. But if you knew the background story, and you understood this was a poetic way of expressing the idea, that a signature could destroy the lives of 100,000, you would see how poetically vivid this is expressing that idea. Rabbi Solovtsky, now this isn't even using deep symbolism, this is just even on a superficial level. Rabbi Solovtsky says, Chazal often employ poetic, metaphoric language. And part of our ignorance is, besides our ignorance of symbolic thinking, which is the main thing the Maharal focuses on, we sometimes have an ignorance of history. And Baruch Hashem, with your very esteemed Rav, I know that everyone here certainly must know their history very well. Rav Wein is such a great historian. But you know, sometimes if you know the historical background to something in a deep way, you can appreciate the poetic expression. Right, so history is also a very helpful key in Agada. Now, it's not the key the Maharal uses. Admittedly, the Maharal does not use deep historical analysis that much. The Maharal focuses more on theology, philosophy, and symbolism. And that's, you know, that I think is the primary tool. But history is a good tool too. Even in Pirkei Avot, forget about regular Agada, even in Pirkei Avot, you know, when a certain mimer is attributed to a certain rabbi, if you know the rabbi's life and you know the events of his life and you know what was going on at the time, you can see exactly why he was the one who said that particular thing. That's a very useful and helpful approach to kind of, through history, understanding the meaning of a Maimer Chazal. Okay? So again, we will continue next week. Hopefully we'll begin an actual Agada next week, but I'm also going to continue my introduction because, number one, I want to talk about the Maharal some more. Number two, I want to talk about Rav Kook some more as well as a person, because to understand his work, you do have to understand the person as well. And he is a person that is certainly very, very worthy to get to know. Okay. Have a good week.
Now. Thank you, Rabbi. It's absolutely beautiful.
I'm ready.
Henry, we'll open the kitchen. We'll open the kitchen. We'll sit here. I mean, that was unbelievable. So I don't have the keys, though, to the kitchen. Do you?
Okay.
What?